Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, health technology, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, we speak with Dr. Bob Kocher, a partner at Venrock, a venture capital entity focused on health tech and health services startups. He's also a former economic advisor to the Obama administration on health policy and talks about the importance of a public-private health system to foster real innovation in healthcare. Laurie Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of factcheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. You can find the show on chcradio.com or wherever you listen to podcasts as well. And you can ask Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Bob Kocher of Venrock here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Bob Kocher, partner at Venrock, a venture capital firm specializing in healthcare IT and health service startups. He's an adjunct professor of medicine at Stanford Medical School and a senior fellow at the Leonard Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics at USC. Dr. Kocher served on the National Economic Council, a special assistant to the President for Healthcare and Economic Policy in the Obama administration. He earned his medical degree from George Washington University and completed his residency in internal medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess and the Harvard Medical School. Dr. Kocher, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have such a distinguished career. You helped guide the Obama administration in the development of the Affordable Care Act. And I noticed also that you and our good friend Don Berwick also authored an article in HealthFare's blog on how to improve the ACA. But you've also recently stated that we should tread carefully in marching towards Medicare for All. And I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners why you believe the public-private partnership is so essential to the continued transformation of healthcare in America.
I think there's three central problems that we try to address simultaneously. The first is healthcare costs way too much. Patients, when they go to the doctor or the hospital, you know, are astonished by the prices. And nearly always, it's the most expensive thing they will do that entire month that they might go see a doctor. And so we have to first be guardians of the money and do everything we can to make healthcare more affordable for patients. And Medicare for All is one way to do that, but there's other ways to do it too, which is redesigning benefits to have lower cost sharing, provide more subsidies. There's lots of ways we can tackle that problem. Number two is we need to make the experience of healthcare suck a lot less. Being a patient is terrible. Things get forgotten. You need a caregiver to make sure people wash their hands when they walk in your room. Your medications are confusing. The bureaucratic paperwork is infuriating. And so we have to make the system itself be designed a lot more like everything else that we experience in life, which is enabled by tech and made much, much less friction filled. Then number three, we need to make quality better. It's astonishing that medical errors are the fourth leading cause of death. And so I believe the way to do that is to actually challenge America to do it. And private sector entrepreneurs, the experiments you get, I believe outweigh the complexity that we have by having lots of people playing as payers and providers. And so I'm hopeful that we will actually, by changing the incentives, which the ACA did and MACRA pushed forward about how we pay for healthcare, will enable a whole generation of innovators to come and just show us better approaches. We've also, with electronic health records and the effort to liberate the data, created a bunch more information that might allow people to design better systems of care. So my premise is it will happen faster if we allow both the government and the market to do it together. And I'm psyched that we see like Medicare actually being often the first creator of payment models, and then we see them copied by the private sector. Conversely, I'm super excited by what we're seeing in the private sector and Medicare Advantage around building things like hospital in the home and care teams that really are capitated in ways that allow them to do a lot of social determinants. And so I think it's that combination that can work fastest and most effectively.
Well, Bob, you recently noted that many startup entities, of which there seems to be a crowded playing field, are seeking relationships with the large insurance companies who you know have the resources to fund some good ideas, new ideas, and innovations in care. I wonder if you would elaborate for our listeners on some of these sort of failing fast scenario of trying things out, seeing if they work and moving on, is really characterizing kind of a new age in innovation and healthcare and can get at both the issues of cost, but also that customer experience.
So we're seeing a lot more appetite by large health plans to try new things. And we've also seen startups get more excited about the health plans because they actually have a couple things at their disposal that employers or we as consumers don't, which is benefit design. And so if you're trying to build a new way to take care of diabetes or behavioral health care or telemedicine, what's interesting about a health plan is that they can make the health insurance benefit reward or incentivize or enable somebody to do that more easily than an employer often can. So a giant problem if you have a better approach to diabetes treatment or mental health care, like I said, you know, a large employer may only have a few people who have that problem. And so you spend a lot of time and money trying to find them and then invite them to try your service. A health plan has thousands of people often with a disease that you want to target. And so you have a chance to actually reach a lot more patients more quickly through a health plan. And then the health plan has more incentive than often employers do because they keep all the savings. And so now historically, health plans have not been great at this. You know, many people don't have a login through the health plan portal because the health plan portals on the internet were so bad you wouldn't need them.
Right.
One of the things that the ACA did was create free preventative care for all Americans, and yet people still don't get that. And part of that's an awareness problem that you think that you're going to get a bill afterwards. And so health plans need to improve on their marketing capabilities for sure. But I'd also say we're seeing large employers get fatigued by, you know, historically, you know, buying all these things that they wrap around their health benefit and then having employees sort of not use them. And so health plans, I think, are going to be the place that you see a lot of innovation.
You know, I want to pull the thread a little on that. Employers are shouldering a huge cost burden in the healthcare system. And we've had conversations with the folks who are doing the Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, JP Morgan Chase initiative to seek ways around that, forming alliances to bypass large payers and streamline their healthcare costs. And I'm wondering if you could talk to our listeners about the potential for these new alliances and what other entities are poised to have similar impact.
Well, I think they're already having impact. I would argue a lot of the reason why payers are becoming more receptive and excited about partnering with startups is the fact that they're seeing employers question whether or not payers should exist by asserting that we can make new, better ones, like what is happening with them, which is the Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, JP Morgan initiative, and Walmart and Comcast have been leaders as well in trying to redesign the interface between health plans and employers. And so first, it's shaking things up, which I think is really positive for patients and promising that we'll hopefully bring some better things to all of us through our health plans. Number two, it's going to be hard, I think, on cost to make a big dent, but I think it'll be easy on the experience. And so I am very bullish that innovators will make the user experience of accessing healthcare a lot better because they'll bring to bear awesome technologists, great engineers, a bunch of data, and the mindset that a consumer products company would have towards how to make healthcare work for people. On the cost side, I think there's nobody more talented at thinking about cost than Dr. Atul Gawande. So I think certainly they'll identify opportunities. The hard part's going to be in negotiating with the hospitals. When you're a large employer, you have a lot of people that you cover, but they're scattered all across the country. So in any given hospital, you might only have 1% to 2% of the patients in that hospital, and they're largely there for labor and delivery. And so you don't really have that much market share or volume or breadth of patients that you can likely, I think, get hospitals to change how they work and offer you large discounts. Another challenge you have is that just with such a young and healthy population, you're not going to attack a lot of the things that drive a lot of healthcare costs, which are end-of-life care, cancer care, and the very frail, vulnerable populations that we see in the Medicare population. And so I think it's easier to go after costs when you have a Medicare population than a commercial population. Walmart's been a real leader for many years on offering healthcare benefits to their employees on lower-cost generic drugs, in-store primary care. And so I think you're going to continue to see them being quite innovative. Comcast is another employer who's built a really interesting approach to offering health benefits to their employees. They actually offer much lower cost sharing than other large employers and have seen flat cost growth because they're quite good at engaging patients in primary care. And then there's some notable health plans. What North Carolina Blue is doing around bringing primary care to the market and changing the payment models is really exciting. So I think Haven, in part, kicked off a wave of innovation and creativity in response to large employers signaling that they may actually not be willing to accept the status quo.
Well, Bob, I want to talk about something near and dear to our model of healthcare delivery and something it sounds like you have also identified as critical, and that's really bringing behavioral health services or mental health services into the healthcare settings. We know as longtime organizers of this kind of care, it doesn't happen by waving a magic wand. It takes a lot of redesign, changes in the way people are educated and trained. Maybe share with us a little bit about how you came to the conclusion that that was one of the essential things that needed to change if we're really going to improve healthcare.
I would first start by saying it's just so obvious. In America's healthcare system, we overutilize virtually everything in healthcare except for mental health care. And that's just a disaster, because if a patient is depressed or anxious or unable to think properly because of psychosis or other mental health care conditions, I can't imagine how they're possibly going to comply with my advice for how to better treat their diabetes and heart disease. And we nag patients all the time to take their medicines and to call us when they don't feel well and to not go to the ER, but to go to their primary care doctor first. But if you've ever known a patient or experienced anxiety or depression or mental health care, you realize that that's crazy, that you're thinking that a patient's going to be able to pay attention to these chronic condition problems that I'm talking to them about and trying to get a HEDIS measure. And so the only way we're going to bend the healthcare cost curve is to actually spend more on behavioral health care so that we can really treat these conditions well. What's wonderful is that for behavioral care conditions, the treatments that we offer patients are every bit as effective as the pills we offer people for their other conditions. Like, we have treatments that work. And sadly, because these things are done with skilled caregivers as opposed to, you know, things you swallow, we haven't spent the time marketing them and building PBMs around them to distribute them. And so it's just not been a priority of the fee-for-service healthcare system, because investing in behavioral healthcare lowers healthcare costs and lowers revenue to hospitals. And so we need to actually create more access and train more people to do these things and take away the barriers to screen and the barriers to treat, because the ROI is enormous on this, not to mention the quality of life that we give people. I'm shocked by the fact that in behavioral healthcare, insurance companies get away with having people in the network that don't practice evidence-based techniques, and they sort of credential them and say it's fine to go see them. We would not allow the variation in care in any other specialty of medicine that we see. So that's frustrating, and we need to fix that. We need to pay the providers enough. That's number two. And then number three, we need to actually do a better job at screening, because so many patients actually live with these conditions and aren't offered treatment, and treatments work.
We're speaking today with Dr. Bob Kocher, a partner at Venrock, a venture capital firm specializing in healthcare IT and healthcare startups. Dr. Kocher served on the National Economic Council as special assistant to President Obama for healthcare and economic policy. You know, I want to go back to that article that you wrote. You and Don were both sort of saying it would be too much of a shock to our system to try to get Medicare for All through. That it obviously doesn't seem possible with the Republican Senate, but you were really looking tactically at how we can improve the Affordable Care Act. I thought you had some very interesting observations there. Just on the tactical side, do you really think this Congress over the last 8 years, who have not been able to improve the legislation of Affordable Care Act, can really get some of these low-hanging fruits accomplished?
I think it's amazing how well the Affordable Care Act has worked, despite every effort by the Congress to undermine the way it is administered and implemented, and to chip away by either incompetence or aggressive desires to undermine the law. We see actually slightly more people enrolled in healthcare today than we did 8 years ago, and healthcare costs continue to grow more slowly than they have in the past. And so, I'd say the imperfect vehicle is working more perfectly than one might expect, given the leadership that's being delivered to it today by the current administration, who's seeking to harm the law every way they can. I don't think the current Congress is going to do anything, because the presidential election that's, you know, looming on the horizon makes it politically too scary for a Republican to vote for anything that actually makes healthcare better. I think you'll see the Democratic candidates continue to campaign vigorously on the fact that they'll be much better stewards of our healthcare than Republicans who thought to throw out the law and continue to support a lawsuit that actually would eliminate the law immediately and leave people uninsured. I was pleased to see Joe Biden's campaign actually pick up on many of the ideas that Dr. Burwell and I put forward. We suggested that one of the most important things we can do today to make the ACA work better is to make the subsidies more generous for people, so that the cost sharing, once you get insurance, doesn't keep you from going to the doctor. And the Biden proposal also eliminate the phase-out point at 400% of federal poverty, so many more people will get subsidies with their plan. Mm-hmm. A third thing they do, which I think is clever, is for states that chose not to expand Medicaid, they'll offer private insurance 100% subsidized for those patients who'd be eligible for Medicaid and today are not able to get it. And so I think that that's a great way to show how off the foundation of the ACA, you can do a bunch to make healthcare more accessible, more affordable. The most important thing to keep doing is to then start working on fundamentally the cost problem, and that's pushing forward more payment models that reward doctors for more productive, higher quality, lower cost care. We have to look at hospital market power. It's the prices that are the problem, and hospital prices are super high, as are drug prices. And so we have to look at both of those things, and I hope that you'll see, you know, Democratic candidates come up with more proposals on those topics.
Well, Bob, you know, one area we haven't touched on that you identified a decade ago as something that really had to change if we were going to have major systemic reform in how we organize and deliver care and the outcomes that we get was medical education. So you've traveled some years since your own education and training at Harvard Medical School and at Beth Israel. You've seen probably a lot change. You've probably also seen quite a bit remain the same. Tell us what you've seen change and what you think really remains out there as major, not yet delivered upon needs in terms of the way we recruit, we educate, and we train the next generation to deliver care in this redesigned system.
Well, first, I continue to be inspired by medical students that I get to work with and residents that I meet who are drawn to healthcare because it's a privilege to get to help people with illnesses live better. I think we need to do more to actually expand the aperture of people who can choose to become a doctor or a physician's assistant or nurse practitioner or across healthcare professions to make sure that cost is not a problem. And so I proposed about a decade ago that we should make medical school free if you choose to go into a primary care profession, because we need more primary care providers. We need more diversity in that population. And so I would like to make debt not an issue for people who choose that path, because we benefit from a more diverse care provider population for sure. Secondly, I propose that, you know, we should have a tax if you choose to become a specialist, because specialists today make disproportionately more than primary care providers. And that doesn't seem like the right incentive if we want to have primary care providers be the stewards of value-based care and care coordination and do all the extra work that we're asking them to do. I think that we should think about how we pay providers. And one thing is we should make medical school more expensive, people who choose to go down the path of being a Uber specialist. I think we need to do a lot to actually kind of change the way different medical professions are characterized to young students, to take the stigma away from choosing things like psychiatry, home care, and physiatry, and hospice, and geriatrics. Because in many medical schools, you know, the neurosurgeons, the CT surgeons, and the surgical specialists are sort of viewed as like the most important faculty and the most important professions. And that's, we need to reset that, because that's simply not true in real life. And I think medical students should be exposed to the fact that you can have an incredibly rewarding and exciting career. And I think over time, we're going to see that. The payment models that we have, shared savings payment models and capitation models, you're seeing many primary care doctors actually earn as much as specialists when they're successful. And I think that will also help sort of draw more people towards those professions. But I think first we should take away the cost barrier, because I've had many medical students tell me that they'd love to be an internal medicine doctor or a geriatrician, but they have too much debt. And so they have to go into something that, you know, especially which makes me, you know, feel super sad.
Well, that's great. And I think we could not agree with you more about expanding the capacity of the primary care provider. Let me give a shameless plug here. One of our startups here is called Confer Med, where we do e-consults all over the country in 41 specialty areas, really focused in on safety net populations. And we published in the December Health Affairs showing the economic model that we worked with our Medicaid department on. 60% of the referrals going from primary care providers to specialists can be managed locally, but the role there can change. But I do want to shift to the role that you're and the work that you're doing at Venrock, and really trying to maybe share with our listeners about the opportunity that you're given there. You're able to work with some of our friends, Farzad Mustashari, Todd Park, obviously former Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, and others. But walk us through the lens that you put on as somebody in the venture field about healthcare startups. What sort of makes them successful, And what's on the horizon as you look at opportunities to make limited investments that might be a force multiplier in the world of the startups?
Well, the most important thing is inspirational leaders. And so I'm blessed to work with some wonderful folks like Dr. Mostashari and Todd Park that you mentioned, who wake up every day and try to make healthcare better. And it's a pleasure to get to help them think ahead to figure out how do we work our way through barriers and how do we create scalable businesses and how do we bring the right talent to the businesses. After having an inspirational, great CEO, the second thing that's really important is to blend healthcare expertise with non-healthcare expertise. And so what makes many startups really go is that we're able to hire some product designers and engineers who can bring kind of a clean sheet of paper and a lack of how things have been done before to help us think through how to redesign things to actually work a lot better. And you couple that to people who know all the rules and sort of which patients are going to be affected in which ways. And that's the magic. It's that combination. And so I think a lot about how do we create that environment for learning and for creation of products and companies that will be hard for the incumbents to make because they live every day sort of mired in the spaghetti, which is healthcare. That's number one. In terms of where opportunity exists, the first one's around labor productivity. Healthcare has been such a giant jobs program in America and been the largest source of jobs over in the recovery. And while that's wonderful, it also means that we're not getting as efficient as you might expect. And so there's a whole lot of people doing administrative things in healthcare, whether that's coding or collections or revenue cycle or marketing or faxing forms back and forth. There's a lot of ways one could have streamlined the administrative bureaucracies here, I think, to use software to make it work better and faster and cheaper, number one. Number two is we do a whole lot of care in these giant buildings that have, you know, poor parking and confusing layouts called hospitals and health systems. And it's much better to do care in the home or in a primary care doctor's office. And so I think we'll see a lot of innovation on how we can do hospital level care in your home. If you come and see a PCP in their office and you need to be given IV medications, instead of sending to an ER or hospital, they can send you to your home and have a nurse and telemedicine help set these things up for you. So I think we'll see home used a lot more often. There's a lot less infections that happen in your home. The food's a lot better. Your bed's more comfortable. You don't get woken up all the time. Patients do better if you can care for them in their home. So I think we'll see a lot more innovation in your home. We'll see a lot more done through asynchronous engagement with your primary care doctor over text. You'll see medications adjusted more quickly. Unfortunately, most patients, you know, start a medicine and then don't see their doctor for several weeks, then start, you know, and so it takes a year to get you fully effectively dosed. You'll see a lot of innovation in the medicine space. And I think you're going to see some really great things done with, you know, artificial intelligence helping us be much better at identifying patients who are at great risk and intervening sooner to avoid complications. Thank you very much.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Bob Kocher, a partner at Venrock and a senior fellow at the Leonard Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics at USC. You can learn more about his work by going to venrock.com or follow him on Twitter at Venrock or at Bob Kocher. Bob, we really want to thank you for all your contributions to healthcare, for your contributions to transforming healthcare, and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lurie, what have you got for us this week?
Were detainees in Border Patrol facilities told by guards to drink water from toilets? That's what at least four Democratic lawmakers claimed after visiting Customs and Border Protection detention facilities in Texas for migrants apprehended trying to illegally cross the border. But it's unclear whether the reference to toilets was to a sink-toilet combination unit and the tap water from the sink part. From a fact-checking perspective, this claim is akin to hearsay in court. We can't say what unidentified guards told unidentified detainees or what those detainees then told lawmakers, but we can lay out what we do know. On July 1st, after the visit to detention facilities, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York said on Twitter, quote, "Officers were keeping women in cells with no water and had told them to drink out of the toilets." Two lawmakers from Texas and another from California also made that claim. The U.S. political editor with the Daily Mail questioned on Twitter whether the toilets had sinks with faucets on top of them, as he showed in a picture from a different facility. Ocasio-Cortez responded to that tweet saying it was indeed a toilet like that, but there was, quote, "just one and the sink portion was not functioning." She said, quote, "so the women were told they could drink out of the bowl." Clara Long, the deputy Washington director of Human Rights Watch, told MSNBC that asking people to drink from the tap that sits on top of the toilet is common practice across the border, but it's not drinking out of the bowl. Customs and Border Protection issued a statement that said it, quote, "takes allegations of mistreatment of individuals in our facilities seriously," and that it reports them to the DHS Office of the Inspector General and the CBP Office of Professional Responsibility. Anyone violating the CBP standards would be held accountable, it said. One final point. BuzzFeed News noted that there have been complaints about detainees being told to drink from toilet tanks before. A 2014 complaint filed by immigrant legal groups on behalf of 116 children held in custody included a complaint from a child who said her only drinking water came from a toilet tank. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Tinnitus is a vexing condition that afflicts millions of Americans, a condition for which there is really no viable treatment to date, but a University of Michigan researcher may have found a solution. Lead researcher Dr. Susan Shore says tinnitus, marked by a constant ringing in the ears, is really the results of misfiring brain signals. Her team has developed a device aimed at getting to the root cause of tinnitus, neurons in the region of the brain stem called the cochlear nucleus. When those cells become hyperactive, they create a signal that is transmitted to the part of the brain where hearing perception occurs, and the constant ringing can wreak havoc on sufferers' lives.
What you're doing is you're tricking the brain into altering its circuitry to go back to normal.
The device is called a targeted bimodal auditory somatosensory stimulation and works on two fronts. It uses both weak electrical impulses targeted to the brain stem region responsible for the problem and also sends timed sound to interrupt the auditory sensation caused by the tinnitus. Dr. Shore says they found it more successful with tinnitus sufferers who were able to control the condition already through certain facial movements.
We developed this treatment for a particular class of tinnitus in which the person who has the tinnitus is able to modulate either the pitch or the loudness of their tinnitus by pushing on their face or pushing on their forehead or clenching their jaw.
The study group has been relatively small so far, just a few dozen participants, but the results have been quite promising. Dr. Shore says that the severity of the tinnitus was greatly reduced in most of the participants, and some got to the point where it no longer interfered with their daily lives. She says they're hoping to enlist more participants to advance their research on preventing tinnitus symptoms from reoccurring.
We need a good solution for tinnitus, as it's affecting millions of people.
A relatively simple, targeted device that could potentially help millions of tinnitus sufferers from the worst effects of their condition, allowing them to diminish or even ignore what is often a debilitating condition for many to live with. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.